Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and I'm here, unfortunately, to report a tragic situation in Gaza, like specifically the Israeli massacre, which took place at the Nusayrat refugee camp. You know, they basically went in there. They it was apparently a rescue operation, American-backed rescue operation to free four POWs in the hands of the Qassam Brigades, Hamas's armed wing. But of course, what that means in the case of an apartheid state, that basically means they're going to go in there, guns blazing, they're going to massacre, you know, drop bombs, bring in heavy artillery strikes, and basically massacre more than 200 people. You know, women, children, elderly. And of course, there's going to be photo ops. There's going to be, you know, the mainstream media in Europe, Canada, the States is going nuts about this supposed Israeli victory. And not really paying giving one iota of attention to the slaughter of the Palestinian people of Nusayrat refugee camp, who already had been displaced multiple times, first from their homes in the north, then to Rafah. And then when Israel attacked Rafah, they were displaced again and ended up in Nusayrat. And then this has been inflicted on them. And I'm going to get into that more detail a little later, but it has to be understood that the reason why there's so much, you know, triumphalism around this massacre, why there's so much press time being given to the supposed Israeli victory, is because Israel is, you know, which, you know, a tactical victory at best. You know what I mean? This is not, does not change the overall situation on the ground whatsoever. Because the overall strategic picture is that Israel is losing. I've been saying this for weeks now, and many commentators have been saying this. The Electronic Intifada has been saying this. Justin Podor on the Empire Project the Anti-Empire Project has been saying this. The Gray Zone's been saying this. You know, it's been very clear. You know, Israel's facing resistance on multiple fronts. They're facing it in Lebanon. You know, now they're talking about going into Lebanon, you know, and flattening Beirut and doing all these kind of things. And the reason why they're saying they're making all these crazy threats is because they're losing on the Lebanese front, just as they're losing in Gaza. They're getting bogged down in the West Bank, fighting there. They're facing, you know, resistance forces in Iraq, in Yemen. They're utterly reliant on U.S. aid. You know, daily U.S. flights of arms and material coming in. Without that, I mean, their goose would have been cooked long ago. Like, they're hanging by a thread, you know, is Israel's position, you know, and they know that. They know that. And that's why you see this increasingly desperate violence. And when, of course, they bring some of their people back, you know, over the bodies of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians, you see this kind of, you know, triumphalism, this kind of, you know, just crowing in the mainstream media. This is why you see that, because they know they're losing. And what I want to do right now is cut to, you know, resistance is working, resistance on the ground. And fundamentally, this is about military, a military defeat for Israel. It's, you know, obviously, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have come out on the streets in recent weeks, recent months. I mean, 100,000 people just this weekend surrounding the White House, you know, in Washington, D.C. That's not trivial by any means. But of course, despite however impressive that resistance is and how courageous the people who are engaged in that resistance on the streets, how courageous they are, ultimately, this is a war that is being won on the battlefield by the resistance against the forces of apartheid Israel, and by extension, the forces of, you know, of the collective West and the American Empire. I mean, they're the ones who are losing, and the resistance is the one that's winning, and they're winning on the battlefield. And I'm just going to start here with a clip from Breakthrough News, where John Elmer of the Electronic Intifada just breaks down, you know, and if you've seen the Electronic Intifada, you know, he goes into, you know, videos put out by the resistance of them, like, you know, taking out Israeli tanks, you know, engaging sniper attacks, you know, rocket fire, you name it. You know, they've been documenting their attacks on Israeli forces and their victories. And John Elmer's really presented that on the Electronic Intifada podcast in very great detail. But this is him on Breakthrough News talking about how Israel is losing, you know, how the resistance is winning. The resistance is effective. And even after months and months and months of just brutal attacks on Gaza, Israel isn't making any progress. Israel is losing. That can't be stressed enough. So let's have a look at that clip right now. Please stay tuned to Back in USSR.
Well, we want to turn our attention to Palestine, which our last guest left us on there in her last sentence, and the ongoing struggle of the resistance, which has not been crushed despite the huge amount of military power that has been directed towards them. Interesting phenomenon, something that deserves more discussion. So for that discussion, we are honored to be joined here by John Elmer, who's a contributing editor at the Electronic Intifada. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Well, great to have you here. And I think, you know, this is a question a lot of people are asking. Of course, the Israeli Defense Forces said, we've cleared out North Gaza, we've cleared out Central Gaza, we control the whole thing. And then now we're back fighting in many of the places they allegedly totally had under control. And we see the bombs, we see the money, we see the planes. So there's obviously something asymmetric happening here that's allowing the resistance to remain resilient despite this huge military force. It's a big question, I guess, to start on, but that's where I wanted to start. I mean, how is it even possible that despite the tens of thousands of tons of bombs in some of these areas, they still seem to be a very effective fighting force?
Yeah, absolutely effective fighting force. They don't seem to be degraded in any way. And as you said, the Israelis claimed that they had control over these areas sometimes as far back as November. And they go back into somewhere like Jabalia in the last few weeks and get hit really hard with all different types of operations, with all different types of communications that seem to show their command and control is still perfectly intact. They're still using appropriate weapons. They're able to move through their tunnels completely. U.S. intelligence estimates say that the Qassam brigades, the main fighting force, are 75% intact still. So what you have is just mass, I mean, you have a genocide. You have mass destruction of Palestinian life, targeting civilian populations who themselves are resisting and resilient in a way that's impressive. But then you have a fighting force that is not degraded and is still able to meet the Israelis anywhere the Israelis are, which is something that's true for Palestinians all over the West Bank, Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. They're able to meet the Israelis wherever they are and with whatever tools they have. In some cases in the West Bank, that's throwing stones. And in the Gaza Strip, it's with anti-tank missiles that were created by the Qassam brigades. It's rockets that were built in Gaza. We saw today a drone dropping a homemade grenade on Israeli forces. We see sniper operations daily, and none of these things match the Israeli casualty numbers that we're seeing, incidentally. Interestingly, to go along with all the other Israeli lies, they lie about their casualties in an effort to keep morale within their state up. And because they know that if they were to see the Israeli population were to see how destructive this war has been on Israeli soldiers, the popularity would be even less than it is, which, according to Yedioth Ahronot, their leading newspaper, only 10% of Israelis think they're winning the war now, 8 months on. 40% think Hamas is winning. So those kind of numbers coming from a place with a military censor, with a news media that looks a lot like the United States, just, you know, not reporting on the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, except from American soldiers' point of view, the Israelis have the same thing. So they're not getting a complete picture of the fight, and they still know they're losing. So, yeah, and I think just the resilience of the population is something that I always want to point out, especially if we're going to talk about the resistance, because the resistance is from the population. They're part of the population. They say they fight in the same trench as their population, and the population is more in support of them today than they were on October 6th. So it's obvious within the Palestinian political milieu that resistance is what leads to popularity in their communities.
You know, John, I had you on Dispatches a few weeks back, and it was an excellent episode. I encourage people to check it out at some point. Not now, because not during the live stream, but when the live stream's over. It was a really good conversation, sort of breaking down the military resistance and what it's accomplished and what it's doing. And, you know, I remember just after October 7th, and then as like the months went on, there was a lot of conversation, and I was in Lebanon most of that time. There was a lot of conversation about, well, how long can Hamas last? How long can the Qassam brigades last? And no one really knew. It was just kind of guesses. And so people were throwing out numbers like 6 months. They're prepared for 6 months. Then you hear they're prepared for 9 months. Then you had some people who on the Zionist side had some wishful thinking saying, oh, they've only got a few weeks. worth until they're out of like weapons and food or something. So we're approaching 8 months. And now, you know, I've been asking this people this question again. And what I'm hearing, at least here in Lebanon, is, you know, no one really knows, but they seem to be doing okay. Obviously, Gaza's not doing okay, but the military resistance is not sending out alerts of like, you guys were about to be extinguished. And I think their ability to fire back in these spaces where the Israelis are saying, oh, we've destroyed all of Hamas there, is a testament to that. And now people are throwing out numbers. And again, no one really knows, but based on the confidence that Hamas military seems to have, you know, 2 years, 3 years maybe that they could, you know, keep doing this. I don't know if that's true. However, the Israelis are saying that they see this going into the end of the year. And then you've got some people saying they could see this happening into a, you know, new Trump administration if Trump were to win the presidential election. And I guess I'm curious, you know, people are wondering, and this is also just like asking you to guess too, but it does, at least at the very least, like, what are your thoughts on how long the Palestinian resistance has been able to maintain its ability to fight up until now and seems to be able to keep going for at least a while longer?
Yeah, and Israel can't stop the war right now, because if they do, they'll lose, and they can't see it like that. And so they've extended their plans. I mean, the Americans gave them till early January to fight, and obviously these red lines have been plowed through for months now. The Abu Obeida, the spokesperson for the Qassam Brigade, said that they're ready to negotiate an end to the war, but also they're ready for a war of attrition, and they're still fighting as a national army. But were that to be degraded, they could fight as a guerrilla force indefinitely. So there's no time when the Palestinian resistance is going to stop fighting. That's not a scenario that's going to happen. We're looking constantly for signposts of any kind of degrading of their capacity, seeing them using weapons that they wouldn't otherwise use if they had full stocks. And we don't see anything like that yet. The Palestinians were patient. They prepared this operation, this attack on October 7th that dismantled the IDF. They planned it for years, and they knew they had a fight on their hands. It's a national liberation struggle, and there's no amount of destruction that will stop this war. Israel has to negotiate an exchange of prisoners and handle some kind of diplomatic solution that deals with the situation in Lebanon, that deals with Ansar Allah in the Red Sea. There's many components to this fight that don't show any signs of slowing up. And dragging out the war is really Israel's way of preventing a defeat, because if they were to withdraw and negotiate for their prisoners, it would be seen as a loss within their society. So they're actually literally letting their people die, if not killing them, rather than negotiating a solution to this conflict that would allow thousands of Palestinian prisoners to be freed and for Israelis to be able to move back into the areas in the south, in the Gaza envelope, that are completely abandoned, just like they are in the north, completely abandoned. Israel's buffer zones are, for the first time in its history, inside of its country. It's lost its strategic depth. There's lots of reasons from an Israeli perspective why you would want to have a diplomatic solution to this fight, but they just don't seem capable of that at all within their current government structure, within their current military structure. You know, the loss of faith, loss of face of their institutions on October 7th to just abandon their people to that catastrophic defeat that they suffered at the hands of the Qassam Brigades. Their attempt to restore faith in the institution is to carry out this brutal genocide that we're watching, where they believe that they can respond to military defeats like their soldier being captured in Jabalia last weekend, by the very next day massacring families inside tents. It's just brutal. And it's a long history of Israel responding to military defeats by massacring the civilian population. But there's all kinds of things happening in Israeli society that show that they can't carry out this war. They're not able to carry out a war of attrition in the same way the Palestinians are. The resilience of the resistance, the resilience of the Palestinian people who are all with the resistance, that equation is a lot stronger than a settler colonial state who have significant percentages of their population holding second passports and can leave the country and will leave the country. The thought that Israel can repopulate the north, the way that Hezbollah has been attacking with just a fraction of their capability, is the same as the Gaza envelope. Who's going to go live in the Gaza envelope after Israel showed everybody that they'll just abandon you in the tunnels rather than negotiate to release you for elderly Palestinian prisoners or Palestinian children who in any other country wouldn't be in a jail and are held in military prisons inside Israel? They've completely lost their way, even from, you know, from their own point of view. And so the Palestinian resilience is far greater than the Israeli resilience. A war of attrition is not going to be something that helps the Israelis out of this situation.
You know, you mentioned this a little bit at the top, and I was hoping you could talk more about it. I mean, the indigenous weapons production that is happening there in Palestine, which I think we've seen, you know, quite a bit of, obviously, in the videos that have come out. But, you know, the advanced nature of it, the tandem charges and the Yassin RPG, all these different pieces. Like, this is not just someone cobbling something together in their garage here. I mean, it seems that this is a major part of how the resistance had prepared for this kind of confrontation, is that they've developed an indigenous capability to produce advanced weaponry.
Yeah, and they could use the weapons that don't explode that are dropped by the Israelis constantly to restock those supplies. But yeah, thing that the genius move that the Palestinian resistance did was instead of having sophisticated weapons that had to be smuggled in, they built their own weapons, copies of historically successful weapons. They didn't try to reinvent the wheel. They perfected it. And they've done that with the tandem charge anti-tank weapon, the Yassin, which allows their fighters to move through tunnels because they're light and move out into the streets, move through the alleys and target tanks from a distance, a very intimate distance. And that weapon, mass produced, is worth far more than more sophisticated weapons that are more cumbersome to move around. And so the fighters have set up a supply of weapons that are perfect for the fight in the Gaza Strip. And Israel's seeing that right now. They don't seem to have any shortage of these weapons, despite the fact, as you said, that some people thought the war would be 3 months, some people thought 6 months. And now Qassam's telling us they're ready for a war of attrition. They're not willing to give in at this point and give in to this, to the ceasefire negotiations. They're making the ceasefire negotiations be determined on the battlefield using weapons that they've developed over the last 25 or 30 years with a philosophy of getting these weapons in the hands of each of their fighters rather than having a few specialized units. They have them in the hands of all of their fighters, and their fighters can operate on a cell-based network and strike from very intimate distance and make these weapons even more successful than they are in their training manuals because they're able to move so close. They know the area. They know the refugee camps. They're using the destruction that Israel has wrought as fighting positions, and that has helped the resistance. So Israel's doesn't even have a good internal strategy, let alone their overarching, dismantling of Zionism that we're watching in front of the entire world. The legitimacy of their project is forever destroyed. And these war crimes charges and just what the world has witnessed will stick with them forever.
You know, John, I want to zoom out for a moment and talk regionally because as we saw yesterday, Nikki Haley, former ambassador to the UN, visited the Gaza envelope area, visited, I think, West Bank settlements, and then went to the north and signed some Israeli bombs with the state, with the statement, finish them, which was so genocidal and disgusting. Because those bombs we know are basically aimed at children intentionally. But all that's to say, she was in the north signing that bomb. And at the end of the day, after Israel's finished in Gaza, whatever it means to be finished, they're going to have to deal with the situation in the north. And of course, they're, you know, Hezbollah says that they've attached their war with Israel in South Lebanon with Israel's genocide in Gaza. The genocide ends, Hezbollah will stop firing. It's not clear that that's the sort of narrative Israel is going to be okay with. They're going to want some sort of victory narrative out of that. And there is a fear that they'll want to escalate into a bigger war because, you know, there is this thinking in some circles in Israel that, first of all, you know, it's like the longer we wait to take on Hezbollah, the stronger they're going to be, but they're already too strong. And they're kind of being held back at the moment by the Americans on that front, because the Americans don't think the Israelis can win. But I guess I want to ask for your analysis on what the Israelis, I mean, nobody knows what they're going to do. They're quite illogical and unpredictable, but maybe they're not suicidal. I don't know. But if Israel were to engage in some sort of broader war on Lebanon, what might that look like for Israel?
Oh, I mean, Hezbollah has the ability to attack with precision missiles all over Israel in a way that the Palestinians simply do not. The Palestinians are besieged in an enclave that they have been besieged in for an entire generation. Hezbollah is the exact opposite. Hezbollah has thousands of cadre that have fought for the last decade. They fought in Syria. They train in Iran. They have all the connections to the outside world that are necessary for bringing in these kind of weapons. Israel provoking an open war with Hezbollah would change the state of Israel forever. People will just simply not want to live in that state once they realize what capacity Hezbollah has. So, but people are saying they're not going to move back into the north unless there's a fight in the north. Even people were saying on that 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, she went up to Matula and the settlement head said that 40% of people won't move back to those communities if there's a negotiated settlement. They demand a war. And that war is just going to be so destructive for Israel that I think, it'll hasten the decline of their state. And that's the reason, at least in part, why the Americans don't want the Israelis to do that. Because I think the American assessments of Hezbollah are a little bit more sober than the Israelis, who are, dealing with generation-long now defeats in 2000, defeats in 2006, rules of engagement that are determined by Hezbollah in the north. And so there's a lot of, military prestige that has been robbed of the Israelis by Hezbollah. And it's in that window that the Palestinians in Gaza have fought. The Palestinians watched the 2006 defeat. They prepared in the same way, the same use of tunnels, the same to protect their fighters, to store their weapons. And so these lessons between Palestinians and Hezbollah have been exchanged back and forth for multiple generations now. It's hard to see the way that Israel benefits by attacking Hezbollah. The entire state of Israel would just be living in bomb shelters because Hezbollah has missile capacity that Israel has never faced before, and they have it in enormous numbers. We don't know the exact numbers, but even Israeli and American estimates suggest that the country of Israel would never be the same if there was a war with Hezbollah. Just frankly, it's just the truth.
Somewhat speculation,
Eugene,
but it feels... Can you hear me now?
Muted, but you're fine now. Yes.
Perfect. Sorry about that, but it's... This is also speculation, I was saying, but it seems like there's almost a downstream effect here on how we also view the U.S. military. Because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of the same weaponry, F-35s, F-16s, but similar kind of military strategy as well. And it feels that the exposure of the Israeli military here in this context is also maybe saying something about sort of the broader Western military machines that hold themselves out as all powerful, omnipotent and can crush anyone, that perhaps that isn't as true as it sounds when the weapons contractors are talking about it.
Yeah, and you could see that on October 7th. Israel had this billion-dollar iron wall that they bragged about for years that they were building. They built it down into the ground to try to stop the tunnels that were going underneath. They have this entire signals network above with computers connecting automatic machine guns, the whole deal. It was dismantled by off-the-shelf drones dropping Qassam-made munitions on top of them. and completely turned them dark. The Israelis didn't have any command and control for the entire day of October 7th. In fact, they didn't have it for some days after. They were still fighting in the envelope on the Friday after the Saturday attack, so almost an entire week later. And Israel's been shown to not be the ally that they were thought to be, the imperial outpost in the Middle East, because they're a liability. They're a liability to the American project at this point. They're dismantling the entire post-World War II architecture that has served the Americans so well. And then on their fighting prowess, you have just like straight up American soldiers making fun of the Israelis for their pathetic training and capacity on the battlefield. And all of these things are emboldening Israel's enemies. It doesn't make, there's no deterrence happening here. It's quite the opposite. If you can't defeat Hamas in a besieged territory where they're building their own weapons, you're not going to stand a chance against a much larger force, a much better armed force, a much better prepared force in Hezbollah. And so I think the Americans are trying to hold Israel back, because they see them as the 51st state in that sense, and they don't want them to destroy themselves. And that's why on October 7th, the Americans immediately dispatched aircraft carriers, advanced surveillance, put drones up in the air, gave Israel assets, air defense assets, intelligence assets, because they needed to focus on Hezbollah and to try to keep that front in check. And the Israelis have needed the Americans at every stage of this. When Iran attacked, it ended up, just by straight numbers, ended up being 3/4 American and their allies protecting Israel. Israel needs airlifts, literally daily airlifts of weapons from the United States to fight this war. They need tens of billions of dollars from Congress repeatedly over and over again to fight this population that's undergoing a genocide that has been blockaded for 20 years. You know, people growing up in Gaza have never left Gaza. They've never seen a Jewish person because the Israelis just policed from the outside like a prison guard. And still, once they moved in, as soon as they moved in, it was just defeat after defeat for the Israelis on tactical levels, on strategic levels. It's been a catastrophic failure for Israel. And that's why they keep going. It's the, you know, sunk cost fallacy. They believe that if they just fight a little more, they'll get one more brigade. And if they get that one more brigade, maybe they'll find their captives. And all of that is just ridiculous. It's not true. It hasn't even been close to happening. Israel hasn't achieved, even modestly achieved, any of its goals in this war. So Israel looks like a liability. Their country is in disarray. They call themselves beleaguered, all from the resistance in Gaza, which has inspired resistance from Hezbollah and, of course, resistance from Ansar Allah in Yemen, which is just heroic resistance when you consider what the Yemenis have been through for the last decade at the hands of Saudi American military blockades themselves. It's the people who are blockaded themselves that are coming to the defense of a country that's being blockaded. And so there's a lot of elements to this conflict that go on beyond Gaza that are just simply out of Israel's hands at this point, without some kind of a proper diplomatic solution, that Israel just doesn't seem to have any capacity for that kind of sober strategic thinking. And they just keep digging themselves a deeper and deeper hole so that their state is in question. And their state is in question. The legitimacy of Israel, as it should have been decades ago, is clearly in question in large parts of the world. It's hard here. I'm in Canada. It's hard in North America sometimes when you're inundated with the media and you think Israel's in a strong position. The entire world sees what Israel is doing. They see them as the killers of children. They don't see them at any military success at all. And it started with October 7th when they were completely dismantled. Their Gaza division was dismantled literally in minutes. Within a half an hour, their Gaza command completely crumbled. Their command and control didn't function at all. Soldiers were fighting and taking body armor off other dead soldiers to fight. This isn't the state that that Americans believed were getting these tens of billions of dollars every few years to outfit themselves technologically, their constant training. It was all just shown to be a ruse. And what's been shown to be successful are copies of Soviet and Chinese weapons from 50 years ago that have been improved upon by the Kassam brigades and to devastating effect, plus the tunnel network that Palestinians literally dug with their own hands over the course of 20 years to protect their fighters, to allow their fighters to move around, and to make occupation of Gaza impossible in any way. They can't hold any territory at all. And so they massacre the civilians in the hope that that will somehow put pressure. If you starve them to death, if you bomb them in tent camps with American munitions that they call a small diameter bomb that was dropped in the middle of a group of tents that number tens of thousands. It's just a horrific scene in Rafah. And this is made in America. It's a made in America defeat of the Israelis, and it's a made in Gaza victory for the Palestinians. And I think that that's something that history will point to for a long time. War colleges will study this for generations to come, and liberation struggles will see what is possible. And like your previous guest said, we don't get to despair when the Palestinians under these brutal circumstances can show us victory.
Well, John, we really appreciate you here, and you're covering all of this very closely and very consistently at the Electronic Intifada. So I hope everyone is checking you out there. John Elmer, contributing editor at the Electronic Intifada. Thanks so much for some of your time here in the Freedom Side.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listening to Back in the USSR here at 93.3 FM CFRU, that was John Elmer of the Electronic Intifada talking on Breakthrough News just last week about the overall military situation in Palestine and how apartheid Israel is losing this war. And the situation, this massacre at Nusrat camp just yesterday does not change that equation at all. So I'm gonna turn now to the latest sit rep by the Anti-Empire Project. So that's Justin Poldor. He also had John Elmer on the show to talk about what happened in Nusrat camp, to unpack what happened. So I think it's important that we do more of a deep dive into that. So that's what we're going to do right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
All right, Gaza War Day 246. I wasn't supposed to be here. This was a night that I was going to finalize my preparations, but had to finish them up and come. And John is here. Hey, John.
Hey, Justin. We'll never let you go.
Yeah, well, I like I said, I don't know what I'll do when I am actually gone, but we have this night, so we have to talk about what happened in Nusayrat. Another massacre, one of the biggest so far, and apparently it's a giant triumph. It's been celebrated by Tony Blinken as a triumph. It's being celebrated in Israeli media as a great victory. They killed 210 Palestinians, 7 bombings right on this camp. And so, I mean, I think first of all, we might as well just start with just reconstructing the operation as far as we know. So they were in civilian trucks coming from the pier. The first thing I saw was a description by someone who survived, and they said there was a truck. I guess there was somebody who filmed the trucks going by, so that we saw. And then we saw someone say there was a truck that was cooking pots and other cooking equipment. And then they came out and they started shooting. So they started shooting. There's another testimony I saw of people in a house. And there I saw a photo from inside the house. They climbed up a ladder. The lady of the house was there in the window. They shot her right away. And then they went through the house, just killing everybody in sight. All the children, the parents, everybody. And there's a description in the Israeli media where they said how the thing went down. They said the captives were in civilian houses guarded by one guard each. All of the guards the Israelis killed, the Israelis and Americans, because the Americans owned up to being part of the operation.
I think from the intelligence, they owned up to the intelligence.
Okay. Their anti-something hostage, their hostage unit or something, they said, was present since October 7th.
The Americans?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Americans have had Delta Force hostage rescue people apparently in Israel since October 7th. We saw them early in the war. Remember when they went and they were glad-handing and with Biden or with Blinken, and they didn't blur the faces of the guys? So that was how we found out that they were there. But I don't think from what we see, we don't see American participation in this raid beyond intelligence, which it does sound like the intelligence came from the Americans. The Americans have stronger signals intelligence over flight. But it looks like an Israeli raid. All four of the people, the captives, were Israelis, so there wasn't any American connection. I think that the pier connection is that the pier got reinstalled today in the morning and carried six trucks throughout the day. And then I think that that's being mixed up with the fact that the helicopters took off from beside the pier, which they absolutely did. The pier is well within where the helicopter took off with the captives in it after. But I think that actually that just makes sense. That's what the whole point of the Netzarim corridor is. It's a safe area where they can land helicopters. It's got a buffer zone on both sides that has been created, that's more than 600 meters on either side of it. So landing their helicopter at the waterfront, I think makes sense from the way the Netzarim corridor works. I don't think there's a pure connection. People I think made the leap between the two. But there's no, the truck that the Israelis popped out of was like a cube van type truck. It wasn't like an aid truck that came rolling off the port. For operational reasons, that wouldn't make any sense to do for the Israelis. The Israelis already have access to Nusrat refugee camp because of their operations in the Netzarim corridor. So they're able to, and that's the whole purpose of the corridor, to allow them to get into the central Gaza Strip, like the middle of the Gaza Strip, east-west, also north-south, but the east-west corridor allows them to jump off and carry out operations like this. And that's the reason why they want that. But we found that there's no Americans involved in this. There's still at least five American passport holders still in captivity, and none of them were involved in this. The four people that we know, they were taken from Nova, from the music festival, from the rave. Three of them were soldiers, and one of them was the hired guard at the rave. So this is, again, something that we're going to see when the rest of the captives get out, is that there's been deliberate obfuscation about who's civilians and who's not in these that are being held. So these are very obviously prisoners of war. These are soldiers. As soon as the woman that was released today, they released all her photos of her in her military uniform and all the stuff that we hadn't seen for the last 8 months. And then the Americans said that they backed the plan. There's no red line on killing, whatever it was, 200 people. I don't even think we know the exact number right now. They overwhelmed the two hospitals. They massacred people in the market. Like you said, they shot and killed people all the way up the stairs in a civilian home. The captives were being held in a civilian home. They came out looking
well,
pretty good shape.
So they got them, and then I guess they were rolling out, at which point they got into a firefight with resistance. And according to the same Israeli report, they said it became necessary to call in these airstrikes to try to extract our team. In that firefight, they lost at least one officer from their Yamam unit.
Yeah, I think I think he was killed in by the guards. I think he was killed in the breaching operation to get the guards. In. Yeah, so he was a senior officer of the Yamam unit, which is they're highly trained elite, they call them, border police force that do these kind of operations. And apparently they had been training for this operation for weeks. They had built a mock-up of the building. And so they had been practicing over and over again the storming of this building. And then when they do carry it out, you know, the purpose of practicing is so that you don't kill every single civilian you encounter in the course of the mission. Normally, that would be like for a normal army.
Yeah.
That's the goal. I mean, they, you know, when they train for these operations, they train in a box that things pop up, right? And you have to make a decision about who to shoot. And like an old lady will pop up. And if you shoot the old lady in your training, like all the lights come on, everything, you know, like the point is to not do that. And then the IDF, they brag about training for this operation for 3 weeks, waiting for the green light, and go in and just murk everybody that anyone in sight.
And then on their way, so as to finalize their extraction is when they drop these seven bombs.
Yeah, it sounds like they got the resistance hemmed in the second vehicle, it sounds like, and they believed that they were going to get stuck. This is their story. And got into a firefight. But there's killing all around the operation as well.
Right. Like shelling, yeah. Drone attacks. Yeah.
Helicopters.
It's not just those seven
bombs.
And like you said, the hostages are intact. No 8 months of being raped, no premature pregnancy, no. And there have been photos circulating comparing the condition of Palestinians when they leave Israeli torture prisons with these hostages.
As there should be. As there should be. And to think about what these guys come out of captivity for 8 months. Apparently they're watching TV all the time. Like they seem like they were treated very well.
And there would have been plenty of opportunity to kill them during the operation by their guards, which the guards didn't do. So it's just like the mentality of the people holding Israeli prisoners is so different from the Israeli mentality.
Sounds like they're in just like the woman described living in like just one of the richest houses in Gaza and being taken well care of. I mean, they look like they all gained weight. It's almost absurd to think about. And then they're going to come out and they're going to be told that all their family members told them that they were sexually assaulted every day. And they, you know, just like the things these captives are going to learn about their families, their friends, the state they live in, the army that defends them. It's going to be remarkable.
I suppose maybe you overestimate
how
different they are from their society. So their existence disproves various things, but the Israelis will just move on to the next lie. I guess the Americans, I think the Americans probably were more involved. The fact that they, when they made a specific statement saying it wasn't, it wasn't our peer, which is an interesting thing to do, you know, and not believing anything until it's officially denied is generally a good practice.
I noticed that when I read it too, but yeah, it just doesn't make, it doesn't make any operational sense. And the videos of that were recorded by the soldiers that are on the shoreline, they seem to be recording it as like, there. I mean, they obviously make idiotic recordings all the time, but they're making the recording of the helicopter, and you can see the boat on the pier. So there's no reason to bring it in from the pier to carry out an operation like that. For one thing, that would be something that everyone would see, and you would try to get your force in without that kind of, you know, like some of those aid trucks are followed by hundreds of people in some cases. So, but yes, they definitely used civilian vehicles, as they do. This is their main way of raiding in the West Bank. I think there's a lot of things about this raid that look like what a West Bank raid looks like. And of course, we only have the Israeli story, which they're trying to spin it as like their Entebbe moment, like to try to like, this is their moment to rescue Netanyahu's career and to postpone the collapse of the government that looked like it was on deck. And
yeah, by committing the biggest massacre in since the last giant tent massacre.
Yeah. And the Israelis just don't even care about that part. It barely registers in the story.
So it's a great victory for Israel. You know, as Ali Mortada said, you know, you rescued 4 in 8 months. So
yeah,
it'll take you 20 more years to get the rest at this pace.
This does appear to be the first legitimate rescue of their captives. All the other ones have huge asterisks on them. Or the ones in Jabalia, like just recently, where they were all dead.
The Super Bowl one.
And the Super Bowl one was like a low-hanging fruit, which was two people being held by a family, and the family tried to, in negotiations, like international negotiations, making phone calls all over the world from their house in Gaza to try to get a ransom for their people. So that's a super easy operation that nobody had to die in that operation. They killed something, and they killed something like 75 to do that. Because they do this thing where they believe they have to do this diversionary operation. And that's and that also linked that to the
very clever diversionary operation.
Yeah, where you just massacre people two blocks away so that the attention goes there. But they're saying that the mechanized invasion of Darabala was part, which we saw videos from just the other day come out. For that operation, the IDF is saying that operation is apparently a limited operation that was designed to pull Qassam fighters from Nusrat down to Darabala.
I mean, they massacre so many people with no reason and no explanation that it's almost like, I don't even know what they believe. I don't know whether they believe what they're saying.
11 a.m. till 1:30 p.m. The captives are home in Israel at 1:30 p.m. 11 a.m. raid where you attack a market. It's just full of children. The streets are full of children playing. The casualties are wildly disproportionately children. It's just a horror show for people that could have been. I mean, I don't know now that we know that they're soldiers. But these are the people that Hamas, that Qassam said on the first day could go home the next day, October 8th, right? Like they could have been home in their beds October 9th with a nominal, they didn't even demand a prisoner exchange if we can remember back all that long ago. Yeah. Qassam was willing to give the civilians up without an exchange. The exchange only comes as Israel refuses to negotiate. And then after the November exchange, which was civilians that could have been released on the 8th or the 9th, that's when Qassam said, okay, now if you're not going to negotiate in good faith and we're going to keep these people here, the yeah. price isn't going to be zero yeah. when we resume. And so that's when these people started to become part of the prisoner exchange. So it's right. just, I mean, it's just the horror of this.
And speaking of the statements about the price, I mean, we have statements from the resistance, which are basically like, this doesn't change anything. They've said this before. However many captives you kill, we're still going to exchange them for all of our prisoners. Even if it's one, it's going to be one for 10,000. If we have 100, it's going to be 1,000 each, whatever, or 100 each, I guess. So, and Abu Obeida, the spokesman for the Qassam brigades, he made a short statement. I think it was just a written report. I didn't see any audio or anything, but he basically said that they killed some of their hostages in the operation as well. So he said, you know, they rescued some, you know, but they also killed some of their.
Yeah, it would be interesting to follow that and see if that's the case.
Yeah. And then he also pointed out the fact that they can take more, which is something that I've said, you know, and that they did in Jabalia. He said, we haven't lost the ability to take more hostages either. So, you know, there are tactical ups and downs. This is, you know, this, I think it is a tactical, you know, by their criteria, of some kind of tactical victory for the Israelis.
Yeah, certainly. It's the first legitimate recovery of any of their captives but remember the previous ones, they could have had their three in Shujaiya who came mm-hmm. out with their shirts off and their hands above their head.
And they killed them themselves.
And they hunted them and killed them, chased them down and killed them while they were begging not to be shot in Hebrew with SOS written in Hebrew on the walls. So they've had some pretty spectacular failures. Yeah. Multiple, at least, I believe there's at least two raids where they attempted to get prisoners, where the prisoners were killed in the raids. They got the two low-hanging fruit from the civilians at the Super Bowl event. And other yeah. than that, you don't see anything. And even just modest military gains by the Israelis, even just modest intelligence, if those people were living for months in the same building mm-hmm. in Nusrat, and the Israelis have no idea. And this is an example where they claim to have known for several weeks, if not months. But if they were having any kind of military success, we would see these happen. Yeah. They raid entire cities with multiple divisions and come out with zero intelligence.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, We need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke, it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!